In my return here last Sunday after a month away, I seem to have missed an anniversary. I don't believe it was as serious as missing a wedding anniversary. Hope not. But it's still one I should have caught. I was reminded of it in a full-page ad in last Monday's Telegraph, which a number of you maybe read. February 3rd, a week ago Saturday, marked the 50th anniversary since the Nashua Armory was destroyed by fire. The reason that's a significant date for us is that we did not go down with it. The Armory, as many of you know, is located where our classroom and office wing is now and where the White Wing School is housed. And when I looked at this picture, maybe some of you saw it in last Monday's Telegraph, I've seen this many times before, but looking at it again, I realized just how close we came to not having the building that we are in here today. You look at it, and I believe this article is posted on the bulletin board in the dining room. You can check it out during coffee hour. If you look up in one corner here, about where that link is, you see firefighters standing there with their hoses trained on the smoke and the flame as they were moving in this direction. And our resident historian, Bob Sampson, was quoted in that article as saying, "The fire drove us out of the church where the intense heat of the burning building could be felt through the windows." February 3rd was on Sunday that year. Everyone watched from the street to see if we were going to lose our church. The fire department did a magnificent job of keeping the building from burning. Well, as I muse on all this, I thought about how a good number of churches seem to have a fire story somewhere back there in their history. As in the fire of 18 or 19, whenever, when we lost our building, had to pull together and build a new one. So we are certainly fortunate, I would say, that our fire story is about the fire that didn't cost us up our building and actually ended up giving us another one instead by the time it all played out. Well, that's just one story. Church stories have been a lifelong fascination of mine. Perhaps that's because I can't recall a time in my life, going back to my earliest memories, when I wasn't part of a church or a religious body in some way. And that experience has caused me to believe that in addition to all the various stated reasons as to why people want to join up with a religious community, I think one is that they want or they need to be a part of a larger story that they feel they can connect with, feel that they are somehow a part. In 1957, for example, I was 12 years old. I had never heard of the Unitarians or the Universalists. I knew that there were Baptists, and then there was everybody else sort of more or less lumped together. And I would have been hard-pressed to even find Nashua, New Hampshire on a map. And yet, the story of the fire of 57, I guess we can call it, that I just opened up with, is one that has become a part of my own story. It's about me. Not just me, of course, and I hope not me in any selfish or possessive kind of a way, but it's about me in the sense that it is a story of an institution that has become a very important part of my life, and I'm sure any number of you can say the same thing. Because we each take at least a part of our identity, our personal identity. We take that from the groups, the organizations, the institutions that we choose to become a part of. And when we do that, their story becomes a part of our own, and then we in turn contribute to the story of that organization. That's what goes on in churches. Well, I think it's time for me to issue a fair warning at this point. The remainder of this sermon, along with what I'll have to say next week with those whom I'll be sharing the sermon, is meant to help launch our pledge drive for 2007-2008. Now, probably warning was not the best choice of words on my part because it made it sound like the subtext is hold on to your wallets. When actually the message I want to convey, both from our governing board, from me, from those working on the pledge drive, is open your wallets, and we'll get down to some of the more details on that next Sunday. But I want us to devote for a few more minutes here what I see as being one of the common threads, or a common thread that runs through the stories that are told in various churches. And I'm going to focus that down now to those in our liberal, free church, Unitarian Universalist tradition. Each of those kinds of churches has their own story with their own incidents, like the one I just spoke of. But I think there's a larger theme and a greater story in which they are grounded. And I'm going to suggest for our purposes this morning that this greater theme can be captured in a few lines that are a part of a reading in our common hymnal, which only with slight variations has also been in several of the hymnals that have preceded the one that we use now. It's the opening words to selection number 471, which says, "Love is the doctrine of this church." Love is the doctrine of this church. Well, what's that about? It's not primarily about sentiment, especially the kind of sentiment that puts on display as we approach Valentine's Day this Wednesday. Not to disparage that, you know, I'm go do the hearts and the flowers and the candy and all the kinds of things that you usually do, which I know I'll be doing myself. So my own story of my relationship will continue in good stead with my wife. But the phrase, "love is the doctrine of this church," actually has historical roots, clear back to the time when churches in this part of the country were being established, right here in these parts. And on this count, I am indebted to the work and the research of my UU ministerial colleague, the Reverend Alex Blair Wesley, that I want to take and go with for the next several minutes here. Some 6-7 years ago, Alice delivered a series of lectures in various churches around New England under the title of "The Lay and Liberal Doctrine of the Church, the Spirit and Promise of Our Covenant." And the first of those lectures that she gave had the same topic as today's sermon topic: love is the doctrine of this church. And she gave it to the First Unitarian Church of Dedham, Massachusetts, for reasons I hope you'll see in a minute. I'm only skimming the surface here of her very excellent work. So Reverend Wesley pointed out that by about 1630, not even 10 years after the Mayflower landing, there were some 20,000 colonists already here in this land called, they called, New England. And once these colonists got their homes built and at least the rudiments of the town in place, they began to talk about how to have churches. Many of them had come to get away from some of the more repressive and hierarchical ecclesiastical structures that they were bound by in England. They now wanted to form churches on their own terms and according to their own needs. They were devout Christians, but they were suspicious, as they say, of hierarchical structures erected in the name of Christianity. So the way they got things going, according to Reverend Wesley, they had these little town gatherings where they would just get together and talk about the churches that they wanted and how they were going to be run. And somebody was apparently taking minutes at these gatherings, like the ones being held in Dedham in 1637, where it was recorded that these weekly neighborhood meetings were called lovingly to discourse and consult together and prepare for spiritual community in a church society, that we may become further acquainted with the spiritual tempers and gifts of one another. I love 17th century language. Great. And out of these conversations, the church in Dedham was formed, originally congregational, later became Unitarian, and then Unitarian Universalist. So Reverend Wesley did all kinds of digging through these records of these meetings and how these churches got started. I'm just going to read her summary here. "For any who might suppose our 17th century free church ancestors talk mostly about original sin, predestination, and hellfire, I'm glad to tell you not one of those topics is mentioned in the record of the founding of the Dedham Church. The document describes these discussions of 1637 and 38, and the talk they engaged in at each step on the way to their founding. I also love the reference to talk, which means there's a historical precedent for us being blabbermouths. Yeah, they were doing it for 400 years. Alice continues, "In these pages, there's much use of the words reason, reason, and reasoning, but by far the most commonly used words in this written history are affection, embrace, love, loving, and loving." Why? She says, "Because then and now, and for as long as human history lasts, when all is said and done, the integrity of the free church comes down to the loyalty, comes down to our loyalty to the spirit of love in the hearts and minds of our local members." So love is the doctrine of this church, to play it out a little further, does not mean, go to the negative side for a moment, does not mean that we all love each other equally, which is a bit hard to do in a congregation of 315 members. You can't maintain the same level of relationship with everyone. It doesn't mean that we all even necessarily like each other equally, although I would hope that a good spirit of respect and high regard for one another exists among us, as I believe it does. But what the phrase means is that there is a relationship that is being continually defined and redefined. It means that together we form a bond of union in the ways that we seek to come with one another that is more than the sum of our parts. And within this bond of union, we seek ways to be together and for one another, and we work and strive to advance the principles and the values that define our religious faith. I would also say it's this principle of love as a doctrine of this church that helps distinguish for us what it means to be a religious community. I get asked that question from time to time. What is it about you guys that makes you a religious body? You try coming at it this way. While some of what you may hear from this pulpit may on occasion sound like a lecture, this room is not really a lecture hall. And while we have good times socializing with one another, like we'll be doing in a few moments in a wide variety of ways, we're not a social club. And while we enjoy a lot of good discussion and conversations among ourselves on any number of topics, we are not primarily a discussion society. Now, to be sure, many of the things that happen around here are the same kind of things that might happen in a lecture hall or a social club or a discussion society. And that's all well and good because we need to learn, we need to have fun, we need to enjoy one another's company, all those kinds of things. We wouldn't have a heck of a lot to do if we weren't doing those things. But what makes us a religious community is that such things as these, and many more, are grounded in a relationship, which I say is continually in process. And if you can indulge me in just a bit of spatial imagery for a moment, I'd say ours is a relationship with a horizontal piece to it, in terms of how we try to connect with one another, and it has a vertical part to it, as we seek out our relationship with that which we sense is greater than ourselves, our relationship with that larger spirit of life about which we sing every Sunday, and the spirit of love and sacredness that gathers us all in. Well, if all that sounds a little too ethereal for your taste, let me see if I can offer a more on-the-ground example of what I'm trying to say. On and off over the past 7-8 years, I've taught a spring semester continuing studies course at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, through their English department, on the Beat Generation writers. When I do it, it runs one night a week for 14 weeks. And the first one I did was in the spring of 1998. And with some trepidation, never having done such a thing before, I prepared a syllabus and worked on my class presentations and figured out the assignments I would give and wrote up quizzes and all that stuff, and had a very good time with about 15 students for 14 weeks. The course ended, we got to our final session. I did an abbreviated final so we could chat among ourselves for a bit. And then I say goodbye to everybody, and head home. And on the drive home, I was surprised at how mixed, how even contradictory in a way, my feelings were. I felt a sense of accomplishment and satisfaction that I had pulled this course off, and I've been able to pass along some of my knowledge and enthusiasm about a subject, which, as you know, I'm kind of big on. But along with that, I had this surprisingly empty and almost depressing kind of feeling as well. Because I realized unless I just inadvertently run into them somewhere else, I'm never going to see these people again. We all had this good time, and then just ended. And to keep be a truth teller here, over the years since then, there have been a few students that I'm just as glad not to see again, but the larger point is that there was no relationship there, no connection other than one we needed to maintain for a short length of time so they could all get a little closer to their degrees by going to night school. And I understand that, and I accept that. But as much as I enjoy my occasional forays into academia now and then, I'm glad I am where I am. After all, saying love is the doctrine of this classroom doesn't quite work. And it's not supposed to work in a way that saying love is the doctrine of this church does. As in the case of all relationships, like we cultivate here, we do fall short of the ideal. But as we walk together here, we try to uphold a relationship that is greater than the sum of all that we do. I'm going to close these thoughts today on a theme we'll work more on next Sunday. 180 years ago this past fall, a group of nationalists, I guess they were done stabling since it was called Dust Bowl at that time, got together up at the home of what is now the Abbott Spalding House, had conversations among themselves, probably similar to those that Reverend Wesley described, and they formed this church and moved into this building the following spring, June of 1827. If you think of 25 years to be the time span of a generation, and then do a little math, we're the seventh generation to inherit what those people did. And as you'll be hearing next week, the seventh generation theme has some Native American origins to it. The Great Law of Peace of the Iroquois Confederacy, its states in part. In every deliberation, we must continue the impact of our decisions for the next seven generations. Whether they knew it or not, that's what our founders were doing. The deliberations in which we engage and the support that you offer for this congregation is also done just for this generation, and hopefully for seven or more generations to come. But when it comes to us now, we can do no less. Indeed, we can do no more. To validate the decision those people made up in Daniel Abbott's living room and keep this liberal religious community hope and promise alive for us, for as I say, at least another seven generations after us. I hope you'll bear that in mind as our pledge drive goes forward in the next number of weeks. It is about us, and it's about keeping us solvent for another year, but it's about a lot more than that. That's what I've tried to convey here today. So love is a doctrine in this church. This is part of the covenant we make with one another. To be in covenant means to walk together with shared values, shared ideals, and with love and concern for one another. And in the language of our closing hymn, which I believe Kathy Grossman is going to help lead us in that this morning with Jed here, it's number 348. It's called Guide My Feet. I think you can actually do that.